through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Happy Thursday, you guys. We got a matinee Mariners game today, opening the first road series against the Minnesota Twins. First pitch is at 1:10 p.m. We will take you guys right up to pregame. Before we get to any of that, though, we've got some fun planned for you. We got to squeeze all this fun into a one-hour show, so we're getting started right away. This hour of Jake and Stacy brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. Now, there is a conversation that we all thought we'd be having about the Seahawks in January. It's not the one we ended up having. The conversation that's been dominating the Seahawks offseason has been about Russell Wilson. Makes sense. Your franchise quarterback comes out and says, I'm not that happy. I'd like something to change. Of course, it's dominating conversation. It was dominating national conversation. But before any of that happened, Brock Heward said something, and this is from February, like right around when all of this was starting, kind of before the Russell Wilson stuff started. Cut number three, this is what Brock said.
Well, it has to be Jamal Adams. You have to figure that one out first. You've already that is the sunk cost, yeah. Right? You've already made that move. You've already given up the two firsts and a third, and you know that is the domino that then sets the table for everything else. Nothing can really be done. No other move can be made until you take care of the biggest piece of the pie for this team, and that is going to be Jamal Adams.
Now, right around the Super Bowl, Brock Heward and I think all of us on every show were saying, number one priority this offseason, you got to extend Jamal Adams. It's the biggest trade you've ever made. You gave up two first-rounders and more. You mortgage your future. You got to extend him. Update, he is not extended. So, do we have a problem here? I don't think so.
We do not, Houston, we do not have a problem. Because even with Brock coming out and saying that and heard it early on in the offseason, yes, is Jamal Adams a priority for the Seahawks this offseason? Without a doubt. Was it going to get done early on in the process? No. No. Can you win the game in the first quarter, Curtis?
Oh, God.
No.
No!
Oh. No, you cannot.
Guys.
And the first quarter is that January, February, March time for the Seahawks. But you know when you can win the game in the fourth quarter? Or win the game. It's in the fourth quarter.
You've had too much sugar this morning because someone had two cupcakes.
Adrenaline
even
rush.
Though Brenna Rogers
sugar
made
rush.
One for each of us.
I did.
But you turned it down.
I didn't
yes.
turn it down.
Stacey.
I put it on my desk and I said I would eat
no,
it
no,
later.
No,
because
no.
I was
immediately
under,
eat a cupcake
because
when it's 9 a.m.
Wait. Before we have this fight on air in front of everybody.
I'll do it right now.
What was the first thing that came out of your mouth when Curtis said, hey, Brenna made cupcakes. Would you like one?
I don't remember.
You said, I'm on a diet.
Oh, that's the first thing that came out of your mouth.
I try to eat healthy on weekdays.
So you denied
I was gonna
a
save it.
Homemade cupcake
yeah.
from Brenna.
Yes,
and
who
you
I
should
love.
Be ashamed of yourself.
It's a new Oreo flavor from Pillsbury.
I'm so upset because you guys
so
know I love Oreos more than anything in the world.
Yeah, but you turned it down. You
I
left it on
turn
your
it
desk.
Down.
You
I tried said, to I don't want to eat it right now.
You politely turned it down.
And then you ate it.
You're right, because That was a bad move on your part, and
look,
someone had to enjoy the cupcake.
The truth is you can never leave food around Jake. He's like a vacuum cleaner. He will go around. If you leave any unguarded food, he will take it.
Or when you disregard or you disrespect one of our dear friends.
It was she made them with love.
I know
and
that.
You just cast it aside.
No, stop. Don't say that.
So
I love
brazenly.
Brenna. Let's get back to the Jamal Adams conversation.
Okay.
I won't stand for this slander.
Okay. I don't know how we got sidetracked on this, but it is important, though. The Jamal Adams situation, to me, is they are always going to look at the higher price contract negotiations. The mega star, the mega deals, typically they are going to wait until training camp. They do this methodically every single year, and I'm not going to say that they don't multitask, because that would be a really bad illustration of how they approach it. They're doing a million different things and juggling a million different things, but they like to be very focused on the present, which is, hey, we have a process. We have to focus on our own players that are going to hit free agency. Then we look at the free agency market. Then we go into the second wave of free agency. Then we get into the draft. Then we look at who is available after the draft. Then we take care of our big mega stars that we need to re-sign. And so you've seen Bobby Wagner last time around get signed just before training camp. a contract or move ago, you see Russell Wilson, he changed it up, put a deadline on the contract negotiation to April. But originally, when he signed that first extension, when did it happen? Just before training camp. So I think that they're on a normal timeline for what they like to do, Stacey and Curtis. I think that this is something that is in line with the process. But what I'm concerned about is the pressure it then puts on this franchise to get this deal done at that time. If negotiations fall apart, if they don't come together, and they're not willing to meet what Jamal Adams' contract is, or they're able to have some sort of meet in the middle, you've put your franchise in a very difficult position, and it's going to be really, really hard to recover from, because you have this unique window now that if things broke apart, at least you know that you could fall back on potentially trading Jamal Adams. I do not advocate for that. I do not want to see that happen. But here in cut number one, we had Rob Staton on talking about that very situation.
Furthermore, Adams is going to ask, presumably, for $18 to $20 million a year. That I would never pay any, say, $18 to $20 million a year. It doesn't matter if it's Troy Polamalu, Earl Thomas, or Jamal Adams. For me, that kind of money needs to go on elite pass rushers, left tackles, and quarterbacks. And maybe at a pinch, a cornerback as good as Jalen Ramsey. Not for a blitzing box safety, which, if we're just going to be really honest, that is what Jamal Adams is. You're talking, two players of the quality of Gabe Jackson here. You're talking about three cost-effective players, at least, because it's two first rounds and a third. If you trade down, you're talking maybe five or six players there. So overall, what is better for the Seahawks, you could say?
So when you hear Rob Staton lay that out, it makes a lot of sense that if you're not able to get the deal done in the way that you want it to be done as an organization, you could, theoretically, you're not going to get everything back. It would be a disaster that you didn't get Jamal Adams' deal done, but you better get something back for it, right? Mm-hmm. And you can then turn that around, and just like with Frank Clark, turn it around and go from 3 to maybe 10 draft picks this particular draft. So with the approach that they're taking, I don't necessarily think it's the wrong one, but I think it puts a lot of pressure on a situation that is extremely complicated. Here in the cut number two, Joel Corey, the capologist, cap specialist for CBS, talking about how this is going to be a tough one.
I expect them to try to make Jamal Adams a priority, which is not going to be a very easy deal to do based on some of the comments he said before he was traded, and then he's not viewing himself as a traditional safety and just a football player. He wants to defy what happens in NFL. Typically, is you're paid by your positional constraints. We just saw Justin Simmons become the highest paid safety, the first $15 million per year one. But if Adams is thinking he wants much more than that, this is going to be a tough deal to do.
So with that in mind, it is going to be a tough deal to do. Because, Stacey, does Jamal Adams want to get paid like a safety?
No, absolutely not, because he doesn't play like a safety.
He plays like one of the best defensive players in football. And the trade that the Seahawks gave up for Jamal Adams would indicate that is exactly what Jamal Adams is. So you're going to trade for him, and he's going to command anywhere from $18 to $20 million probably. And you know what? You're probably going to be in a position where you're going to have to do it, right? And you look at Jalen Ramsey within your own division, that's exactly what the Rams had to do. They gave up very similar capital for Ramsey to the Jags, and they ended up paying 20 mil per year. So, like I said, Jamal Adams has a ton of leverage on his side because there's a lot of pressure on the organization to make this contract work.
There's a very fair question coming in. I know you talked about it a bit. Very fair question coming in on the text line 710-710. This one from the 360 saying, why can't you just franchise tag Jamal Adams? Because you don't really eliminate any of the problems you're facing right now by not extending him or waiting to extend him. And if anything, you give him more leverage. One of the biggest pieces of leverage a player in the NFL can have is hitting free agency. The franchise tag prevents a player from hitting free agency, but only for 1 year. It's a 1 year contract.
Mm-hmm.
You can franchise tag someone and then reach an agreement on a long-term deal. I think the deadline is usually late July for that. But Obviously, in the meantime, it gives him more leverage because he knows I'm still gone and hitting free agency in a year if you can't get this figured out. Secondly, it's a fixed number. The franchise tag is going to be the average of the top five salaries at the position or 120% of the previous year's salary, whichever is higher. That means that you don't get to be creative with the salary cap the way that we've seen the Seahawks do for Tyler Lockett this year, for Carlos Dunlap, for different guys where they've tried to make a smaller hit up front and then backload a lot of the contract. That's how most NFL contracts are structured, but it's especially been the case with this year's lowered salary cap, and I wouldn't expect next year's salary cap to be where 2022 would have been in a non-pandemic world. It'll still be building up. It'll be much higher, but it's not going to be $210 million. It's going to be getting closer to $200 as opposed to being significantly over that. So I don't think that franchise tagging Jamal Adams is the answer. I think the answer, certainly if you're not going to trade him, and I don't think the answer is trading him, I think the answer is to extend him. And I agree with Brady Henderson, with Bob Condotta, who we've had on to talk about this, that it's looking more and more likely that will happen after the draft. I don't know how much more leverage Jamal Adams gains by you waiting the difference between early May and early July. I think it's negligible, but I do think once the season starts, you're in trouble.
Well, theoretically, the reason why he would gain more leverage is because you're missing a window of opportunity as the team to say, hey, if this doesn't work out, then we're just going to move you, right? You don't get that luxury anymore, right? Not at this point in time. And so you're going to have to deal with the drama of Jamal Adams, of he's going to be on his last year of his deal. What do you do? Do you franchise tag him? Do you eventually try to trade him for very little at that point? You're putting yourself in a really tough spot. And that's why it's going to put a lot of pressure on John Schneider, Matt Thomas, the rest of the crew that's going to deal with this negotiation with Jamal Adams and his agent to get it done, because this is going to be a pivotal time and they can't let him walk given the circumstances. This would have been the opportunity to negotiate now and to trade him now at this point heading into the draft so that the team could recoup something. Doing it after the fact is not going to be favorable to the team. So I believe that you're going to be in a situation here where they do get this deal done, but the one side that you don't want to get into that you've completely avoided is Jamal Adams feeling disrespected. Jamal Adams not being happy with how things are going. Jamal Adams wanting to get something done and the team is not, you know, putting forth the effort that he wants to see. We haven't heard any of that. It's been very, very quiet, which is a good thing. That means that the organization is communicating very well with Jamal Adams. The conversation, the relationship is strong and healthy. You just don't want to get to the other side because we've seen what Jamal Adams is willing to do, right? If he's not happy, he is a guy who is not afraid to make it known and to make it public.
Yeah, but that was with a messed up organization. It's a lot happier, or it's a lot harder to try to pull that with an organization. Like, imagine if Russell Wilson came out, but he played for the Jets and said what he said about the offensive line. Even if their offensive line was relatively equal in production to Seattle, not nearly as many people would have been mad. Because the idea was, here you are bad-mouthing an organization that's been a winning organization and has thrown itself behind you, seemingly, for a while. It was a lot easier for Jamal Adams to do that with the Jets because the Jets were the laughingstock of the NFL for a good portion of the season last year.
Well, I agree with that. It would be a lot more difficult, but at the same time, it's part of the negotiating aspect of things. It's business. Business is business. And so are you willing to get into the mud a little bit if you're not happy with things are going? And Jamal Adams is that kind of guy. He is that bold, brash type of personality that's willing to do some of those things. And I want to avoid that completely. So I like I said, I think this is on track for where it was going to be. This doesn't surprise me to be in this situation, not hear anything about Jamal's deal. I actually think it's really, really positive news, because if you're a player like Jamal Adams and you're anxious and you're nervous about, why isn't the team getting this deal done with me? Am I a priority to them or not? Then you're going to start to hear these whispers. You're going to start to hear that type of conversation come out. We have not heard any of that. So that means that the relationship and the conversation between these two parties is very, very strong and good. And so I think that they're on the same track and same mindset as to when to get this deal done. Therefore, I'm going to feel really confident in saying that we're going to see a contract done here in July you know, just before training camp.
It's a good point. As a reminder, you guys, we have Shannon Dreyer joining us at 11:30 today to give us every update we need to know about James Paxton and Jake Fraley, both of whom left with injury in the game in the White Sox series. We've also got some roster move questions we have for her. And finally, some questions about starting pitching. Some very interesting sound you're going to want to hear from Jerry Dipoto. That's all coming up in 15 minutes. Before we get to that, it's 11:15. That means it's time for Three Questions, brought to you by Tila Mortgage.
It's time for Three Questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 11:15, three burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
That's the dumbest question you could ask. What?
Question number one. With multiple offensive linemen speaking with the Seahawks over the past few days, Chance Warmack among that group, do you expect another 19-player deep pool for them to pick from?
No, Curtis. No. We are not going to get into that situation again. I don't think we're going to get into, hey, we're going to figure this out through competition. You have your offensive line solidified. Now, what I do like and I do appreciate is they're bringing in some interesting names. Chance Warmack, Danny Isadora. They brought in the guy who you know, was with the Tennessee Titans and with the Rams a few years ago. They're finding guys that could be good quality backups. And as we've seen over the past couple of years with the Seahawks, that's unfortunately been very, very important for them. And also what it shows, though, it's kind of an indictment on the guys that you do have. Phil Haynes, right? Jamarco Jones.
Oh, like the backups that they had already drafted.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, you're trying to bring in competition. You're bringing in depth pieces. But these are guys that you're looking at seriously and saying, hey, they've got a real chance to compete with who we have currently on our roster. And those would be those two guys in particular at the guard positions. So I hope that if they do bring those guys in, that the guys that you drafted, Phil Haynes and Jamarco Jones, that they step up, because they just haven't been able to remain healthy and they haven't been able to be reliable backups for you. And that's been unfortunate for this team.
Yeah, that's really been their biggest problem, has been health, because we don't really know what they look like with a consistent season under their belt. And they hopefully wouldn't be getting that anyway as backups. It's certainly not, and this isn't what you were saying, but I just want to emphasize, I don't think it's an indictment on the starting five that they have. It seems they feel really good about that group. You obviously have reason to feel great about Dwayne Brown. He's been nothing but a model of consistency for you. Brandon Schell was a steal in free agency, considering what you paid for him. Damian Lewis, promising rookie season. Ethan Posick, you brought him back. Gabe Jackson, you extended him, and you paid him some good money for it, too. So I think they clearly feel good about that starting five. So I think the hope is just like, well, whatever we have behind them, let's just stay league average. Because something tells me that, like, most teams in the NFL don't have great depth at offensive line. How many years in a row now have we been saying that offensive line play and that offensive linemen coming out of college outside of the first round have had a lot of question marks compared to other position groups?
It's a great point.
Number two.
The Masters starts today. So do you still consider it one of the premier events on the sports calendar?
Yes, without a doubt. The Masters is just, there's a different air to it. And I don't know what it is. Like, Augusta, there's just the majesty of the Masters to me. And even though I'm not tuned in to golf and hardly ever watch it, I always find a way to get myself tuned in for the Masters. And maybe it's the fact that golf does such a great job of hyping up the Masters and the moment and all that, but I always really enjoy the Masters and watching it and keeping up with it, even though I'm not a diehard golf fan that watches the tour and keeps up with everything and who's winning all the different tournament championships and all that stuff. There, I always find time for the Masters.
It's not one of the premier events to me. Like, I don't carve out a ton of time. I'll, like, keep an eye on it, especially the top guys that you need to be following. But I don't make the full of the Masters appointment viewing per se. It's not totally
okay
for me. This is my speed of things. But I will say, credit to the Masters for keeping its own unique feeling for a sporting event that really is unlike almost anything else. There's so much tradition steeped in it that they've managed to keep And I was reading a fascinating article on ESPN talking about how that especially felt the case in kind of this, not pre-COVID, but coming back from COVID just a little bit with still such small groups that it felt even more like this kind of like quiet, prestigious event. And that was really cool to see.
Number three.
What's the most disrespectful thing a person can do when offered free food?
All right. Well, all I said was I don't want to eat it right now, but thank you so much. It looks delicious.
No,
that's not what you said.
Okay. You said that you're on a diet and you don't want to eat it.
And you tried to like make me feel bad for offering you a cupcake.
I did not try to make you feel bad.
I think so.
I mean,
first of all, Brenna makes amazing treats. She's made those cookies before with the different colored chocolate chips, and they were delicious. Well, the only reason I didn't eat the cupcake is also because Jake ate
it. Stacey tried to pull. Not only did she deny it,
you
had
your chance.
Then she tried to do the courtesy.
I didn't know I had a window.
I'm gonna put the cupcake
on this desk when I've got 40 minutes before the show. I can eat it at any time. I'm gonna wait till after the show. Wait till everybody is gone and forgets about it.
Okay.
You know, Stacey, you missed your opportunity. You missed your time. And you clearly weren't going to eat it. So I had to go in there and I had to take it. And I had to eat it and enjoy it. So thank you for making me overindulge on delicious cupcakes at 11 o'clock to start my day.
I apologize in advance when in about 15 minutes, Jake gets way too hyped up for like the conversation that we're having. I'm going to be like, let's talk about James Paxton. And he's going to be in the background like, let's go.
Hey.
How's James doing?
Let's go, man.
Yeah. Some news on him coming up, by the way.
It's better that than him just going through the motions on the air.
All right, that's
true.
Fine.
Brenna, I hope you know that I respect you so much.
I had
two cupcakes. Two of your cupcakes, and they were delicious, by the way.
Okay.
Perfectly moist.
Okay. I have had many things that Brenna has baked before,
and they've always been good. You named a cookie that was like 10 months ago.
Okay. Well, look.
I want everybody to text
in
on the
busy
Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line.
No,
sorry, on the text line.
Do not listen to him.
Text
do
in
not
710-710.
Do not do it.
If someone offers you a cupcake or a treat of any kind,
my gosh,
do you take the treat? Especially when it's a friend.
I took it to
spouse.
Yes,
that
I did
made
take it.
Not
I
just
put
take
it on
it,
my
but
desk.
Eat it. Eat it within 10-15 minutes.
Okay, this is.
I need to know.
This is called bullying. And I won't stand for it.
It's called
on the
etiquette.
Airwaves.
It's called etiquette.
It's called holding it down for your teammate.
It's a new year for the Mariners rebuild, and there's something Jerry DePoto said this morning on Danny and Gallant that has us thinking expectations are different when it comes to starting pitching. Who better to ask then than Mariners insider Shannon Dreher? She knows everything about this team, and she'll tell you what you need to know coming up next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
So much to break down from the Mariners series finale against the White Sox. They're about to have a matinee for their first road trip of the season. We've also got updates from Justin Dunn's night and some injury updates on Jake Fraley and James Paxton before we get to any of that. We're going to help you guys make sense of it all with Mariners insider Shannon Dreher. She joins us now, brought to you by Jafco Plumbing and Sewer. Shannon, how are you?
Not bad. It's odd to be back at the park where we're going to be broadcasting the road games from, and it's empty again. It was great to have the fans, and all of a sudden, you take that step backwards.
At least you got the ballpark feeling, though.
You do, and it's actually a pretty remarkable thing to be like one of the only people in here and have that big window in front of you, and it's like, this is all for me.
There by yourself. I'm gonna start with some of what Jerry DePoto had to say this morning. I'm gonna start by playing this cut. It's cut four. This was him on Dunn's performance the other night.
Yeah, yesterday was a rough day, and you know, frankly, you just don't see that in a big league game. And that was my initial takeaway. I've certainly been out there enough and had control problems, you know, at various points in my career, whether it be an inning or a game, what have you. How I usually approached it was I just apologized to the manager afterward. You know, it's a if you knew how to fix it, you would fix it. You know, he's trying. He's out there trying to throw strikes. And, you know, we did see, again, a market uptick in his stuff. I thought his stuff was crisp. But we just need to be better at throwing strikes. And frankly, with our starting pitching in general, you know, with the exception of what I thought was an outstanding start by Yusei and a really solid outing by Chris Flexen, our starting pitching, which we think is pretty good, needs to be better than it was these first six games. And Justin needs to command the strike zone better if he's going to evolve into a steady starting pitcher in this league. That's for sure.
Shannon, can you explain why that's a bit of a different tone for DePoto?
You know, it seems like it's a little bit of there are two different things there. There's Justin Dunn and there's the entire starting rotation. And I'll go ahead and start with the starting rotation. The Mariners look to kind of lean on that rotation a little bit this year as the hitters come along. They've got a little bit more experience in a good amount of that rotation, and they put a lot into it, and they even going with a six-man rotation is investing in that rotation. So I think that when you looked at the first turn, and it is just the first turn, everybody is coming out of spring training and making adjustments, you know, I thought it was very interesting that Jerry DePoto would say, yeah, we do need a little better from most around here. I don't think any pitcher in that rotation needs to be told that. And again, it was the first one, and you know, you look for something different the second time out. But I thought that was interesting that DePoto actually articulated that. And to me, that kind of ups the expectations, as it should. If last year, and it wasn't a full season, and no, they didn't get those 4 months that they would have gotten had there not been COVID, but last season was about getting the young players experience at the big league level, and it was a very kind of safe environment. This year, it's going to be different. The expectations are going to be different. And at the start, yeah, they're still going to be bringing players along, but there will be more competition. There was competition in spring training for the rotation. There will be more competition once they, I believe that it is the right time to bring up Logan Gilbert, and they have to be careful because they would like to have him in the second half. They'd like to be able to have him pitch toward the end of the season, and if they were to start him right away because his innings limit would be lower, they wouldn't have him for that time. But at some point, he's coming, and that will set up competition. With Dunn, it was kind of interesting. Just one more thing on Dunn, in that all we have heard about him in spring training, the stuff is better, the stuff is better, the stuff is great. Even when he had some struggles in spring training, it was the stuff is great. 8 walks, and he did have a history of the walks last year. I think that this is probably a little bit of a kick in the you-know-where for him. Like, come on, you know what? This has got to translate now at this point. And I think largely with Dunn, I mean, the stuff is there. There's no question about it. I think it's now getting into the games. It's a little bit more in his head. Ryan Roland Smith has talked about focus with him a little bit more. So I think it's just kind of letting them know that, you know, it's not always going to be comfortable. You know, we're trying to bring you along, but at some point, that could change.
Right, and Shannon, the big question is that I think fans would have is, at what point through the rotation can we start being critical, right? The first time around, you go through and, maybe they just didn't have their stuff, maybe they just were uncomfortable, maybe we can, you know, we can give them a pass on their first start of the season. Where is that point where we can really start to evaluate and start to look at what they're doing and what they're presenting out there on the field from a starting pitching perspective and say, hey, this does have to be better. We need to see you be at your best at this point. Second, third time around?
Well, I think it's different with every individual. Marco obviously has the longest track record with all of them, and you hope that last time out was just more of an anomaly than anything else. Yusei Kikuchi, of course, he's got the experience, but this is the first year with the new stuff, or I guess the second year, short season last year, with the new stuff. But the way that he went out, now you can look at that first performance and say, okay, you know, that's kind of a starting point. So I think Marco and Yusei are in one category. Chris Flexen is adjusting. They've gone to great pains to mention that he is young. He did have that full year last year in the Korean baseball organization, but still just 26 years old. Justice Sheffield had a year under his belt last year, a good season last year, and you expect him to start where he left off, and he was kind of feeling for it in his first outing. So I think along those lines, they get a little bit longer of a rope, but not too much. And then in Dunn, he has probably the least experience of all of them, and he should be where Sheffield was last year, but you've got to see forward progress, and walking 8 batters in 5 innings is not quite that.
Yeah. Shannon, what do we need to know about three injuries Kyle Lewis, James Paxton, Jake Fraley.
Kyle Lewis, it sounds like they are very optimistic that he'll be ready to return when the team returns from this road trip. And, you know, everything that I have heard with him is everything is moving forward. He's adding a little bit more to what he does every day, and the final test with him is going to be running. Jake Fraley, it sounds like that was a milder strain than they were expecting, and the hope is that he would be ready to go in 2 weeks. And of course, James Paxton, that's the tough one. We don't have the official word on what that is, but from everything that Jerry DePoto was saying, and Scott Servais kind of confirmed this when we talked to him about an hour ago, they're hoping to have, you know, just kind of a full diagnosis and prognosis in the next 48 hours. That to me said he's gone for a second opinion. That is indeed the case. And when you're talking about second opinions, that's because the options in front of you don't look too good. So unfortunately, that looks like that's not going to be the best news that we hear there. We'll have to wait and see. And then Evan White, it sounds like they're going to hold off putting him on the IL. The hope is that they don't have to put him on the IL. He's had some history with just tightness in that quad. They're hoping a couple of days off his feet will alleviate that.
Now, Shannon, how about that at bat from Ty France yesterday? I mean, the 11 pitches, I know there was some mix-up, 10 pitches, 12 pitches, whatever it was a legendary at-bat. How great has Ty France been thus far this season?
Oh, he's been fantastic, and it's so funny for a guy that you just didn't hear about much before, is the minute the Mariners got him is, oh, yeah, that guy can really hit. And it's one thing to be really able to hit, but also to hit situationally. And we've seen him do that. You know, his approach is just so simple. It's up the middle. And I think that as the season goes on and as it gets warmer, a lot of that up the middle, some of it's going to fly out of the ballpark. He does have good power as well. But for him to get into that situation where he was looking fastball, where he fell behind 0-2, and then just dug in, shortened up his swing, and, you know, that eye is just fantastic, was able to foul off enough and really put the pressure on the pitcher, not just in that at bat, but in what was coming next with Kyle Seager behind him. So it was just, you know, a great at bat, what you want to see in that kind of inning, particularly if he gets into trouble down 0-2. And, you know, I think that's the first time I've seen him do something like that, get that deep into an at bat. And it was just, you know, add that to the bag of tricks that he's got.
She is Mariners insider Shannon Dreyer. Make sure you're following her on Twitter at Shannon Dreyer for updates from today's game. Shannon, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime, guys.
All right. Jake, you already know one of my hills that I've been dying on is that Jimmy Graham was not utilized the right way and was actually a really legit tight end. Mm-hmm. Another hill I'm dying on is baked beans on hot dogs. Pretty solid.
Oh, wrong hill.
Very underrated snack or ballpark food.
No.
The number three hill I'm dying on, I actually think you guys are all going to agree with me because I'm going to give you a really convincing argument.
Okay.
It's about Chris Carson. That's next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
We are taking you around the diamond thanks to the Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. Marco Gonzalez gets the start for a matinee Mariners game, opening up their first road series of the season against the Minnesota Twins. Pregame at noon, immediately following us. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by the Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. Jake, we've got a couple minutes here, so I want to tell you about a video that was making the rounds on Twitter. Before I do that, though, can I just tell you, someone texted in during my defense of Jimmy Graham. From the 425, yes, I'll call you out. They said, Jimmy Graham was a good piece for the Seahawks, only if you like red zone touchdowns.
I love red zone touchdowns.
Is that a bad thing?
Right?
Is that not what you want tight ends to do?
I mean, I guess cake is good if you like sugar and frosting. Yeah, that's actually what we like most about it.
And if scoring points is your thing, I guess.
I guess if winning games is what does it for you, Jimmy Graham was okay.
Out of all,
I don't know
the things,
if that's the defense you want to stack.
Out of all the things you could poke fun at of Jimmy Graham and could, you know, poke holes into his game, the red zone touchdowns is definitely not the strongest argument that you should be making.
Well, if you want to be saying like, oh, he wasn't as good between the 20s, sure, but if he was getting 10 touchdowns, yeah, I'm okay with you not being as good between the 20s.
That's a pretty good piece.
425, I respect the commitment. No, this one instead is about Chris Carson. I think that people have a critique about him that is fair, but a little overstated. For instance, there was a video going around, making the rounds on Twitter, Jake, where Chris Carson, in response to a video from Derrick Henry, is it's a insane looking workout. So he's balancing. He's in a plank. He's balancing with his arms on a resistance band and one foot on a stability ball with weights draped over his back. It's just a phenomenal display of core strength. And it's obviously it's for the gram, right? For the Insta clout. And so it's not meant to actually do anything except for like, hey, here's my response video. I'm working on the off season. Fine. There's a surprising number of responses where people are talking about Chris Carson as though he's CJ Pro Size. And I've rooted for CJ Pro Size to get healthier and prove everyone wrong. But like, there is no comparison between the amount of time missed between these two players, especially how productive Chris Carson has been. And you might be pointing to Derrick Henry and saying like, well, why hasn't he been as productive as Derrick Henry? Jake, you said it best. You were like, Derrick Henry is one of one. It's like saying, why hasn't this guy been as productive last year as Tom Brady, as Travis Kelce? Because he's the best at his job. Because how many other running backs got 2,000 yards, not just last year, but in the last couple years, right? There's a reason everyone says Chris Johnson, CJ2K. Like, you remember those players. Now, what if I told you instead to look at what I think is a more fair player comp, Dalvin Cook, a guy who got a ton done with Minnesota. And what if I told you that actually Chris Carson has appeared in two more games over the last four seasons than Dalvin Cook?
I think it would surprise a lot of people just based off of the narrative of what Chris Carson has done or what he has been and the injury-prone aspect of Chris Carson. I think the problem, Stacey, with Chris Carson, it's more of just about when his injuries have happened than the fact that they have happened at all. The fact that Chris Carson, particularly in 2019, I think, really is etched in people's minds where he played in 15 games. He played in 15 games, but the problem was is he got hurt at the wrong time of the year. He got hurt at the end of the year, and now you're in a situation where you are grasping at straws trying to replace him. You end up bringing Marshawn Lynch back just to try and get some adequate running back play, and you go into the playoffs with that group, and it really hurts you. Right? Chris Carson, having him out on the field for the playoffs, that would have made your team exponentially better, right? And so I think that that is what Chris Carson really suffers from. And then also you talk about 2017, his rookie year, he, you know, had a really devastating injury that, you know, he only was able to play in four games of that year. But outside of that, Chris Carson has been in line with pretty much everybody else in terms of the top running backs out there. In terms of their durability, I mean, look at Christian McCaffrey, right? Mm-hmm. Is everybody saying Christian McCaffrey isn't a good running back anymore? I don't think so. He missed almost the entire year last year. So it is that's why, you know, people say that running back is a very, very difficult position to get on board with in terms of paying big money to and long-term investment into, because they are injury prone. It is one of the tougher positions to play. I mean, you're running downhill. You're expected to take on linebackers and safeties and linemen that are trying to tackle you. I mean, it's a brutal, brutal position. And I think that Chris Carson, the big thing for him this year is, yeah, durability is always going to be one of those things that you question, that you look at, that's going to be a conversation around Chris Carson. But he has been extremely productive, and he has not been CJ Pro Size, where he has missed
it's not even close.
A significant amount of time. It's nowhere even near the same type of comp. Chris Carson has been for you. He's been a mainstay for you every single year over the past 3 years. And I think that here in 2021, Stacey, the Seahawks are going to cut him loose. I don't think that you're going to, and that's why I predicted Chris Carson is going to be a 1,000-yard back again. I think that they're going to cut him loose. They're going to, you know, not play the game of, you know, trying to really have a pitch count on him throughout the entire year. But it's one of those things where, can it be more timely? If he's going to be out a couple games, can it be more timely?
Can it not be at the end of the season?
Right.
I think it's the timing of it.
Or not against the Buffalo Bills and the Rams when you needed him, you know, versus one of the better teams in the NFL.
And that's fair.
I think that those are things that people remember is, was he there for the big moments or the big games or the playoffs when you need him? And that hasn't always been the case.
I think that's exactly why people have pointed to it. Like, I understand the root of why people feel this way. First of all, you missed, what, four regular season games last year? You missed one regular season game the year prior, but it just so happened to be the final game. And, oh, you went on IR because you couldn't play in the postseason. So
right.
The timing of it, I think, is what's prompting people to critique him. But I don't know. I was looking through those comments and I was like, look, say whatever you want about your team. It's not my place to tell you how to be a fan, but I am going to argue with you and I am going to jump in and say that statement about being just like Mr. Glass,
yeah,
way overrated.
I would fully agree with that. Way overstated. It is not Chris Carson at all. And I think that when you play the style of game that he plays, you can see why that he is going to be out for a couple games during the year. I just hope it's a little bit more timely and he's able to be more healthy this year than any other year.
All right, that'll do it for us today. Mariners matinee against the Minnesota Twins coming up next. So do not go anywhere. Stay right here listening to 710 ESPN Seattle.